Listening to the Food Talk Show. Hello there, my name is Sue Nelson and I'm in the studio surrounded by men today. It's packed full of men. Of course, I've got my lovely two boys. Am I allowed to say that?
You
probably
are.
Politically incorrect.
Start being politically correct.
Never. So I'm joined by Ollie Lloyd, Chief Executive of Great British Chefs. Hi, Ollie.
Hi.
No food in the studio today. And Guy Routledge from The Food Rush.
Hello, Sue. How are you doing?
Well, you're still on your vegan thing, so you're pretty pleased there's no food, because at the moment you generally can't take part.
I can't eat anything at the moment. It's very depressing.
You're wasting away before my eyes.
I'm having tofu tonight.
Oh my God. Anyway, do you eat tofu? No.
I think if it's cooked, you know, in certain styles, it works. But there's an Ottolenghi recipe I do, which has a lot of spice in it.
Oh, and tofu. Okay. So that works. The tofu for me is you chew it, but then you keep chewing and you keep chewing. It doesn't seem to break down.
The thing that is crazy about it is you have to like compress it between two massive blocks of wood with I get my pestle and mortar and stuff on top.
Oh, you're actually making it?
Yeah.
I'm going to have a bacon sandwich.
Ooh.
Let's talk about who we're being joined by. Just to annoy you. So we have got Alex Shannon in the studio, who has got Sous Vide Tools is his company, and also Gastronomy Plus, I think. And we're going to talk about Kit in the Kitchen, of which you're an expert, I hope. Ollie tells me you are.
Oh, hope he's got his facts correct there.
I think I'm sure he has. And then we've got Stefan Porter from Heartier, and he knows everything you want to know about local farm shops, don't you, Stefan?
Almost everything.
Good. And then Steve Morkin from Planet Mark. And we've just become a client of yours, haven't we, Steve?
Yeah, you're in the process of becoming certified.
About time I got certified.
Sounds very efficient.
But so my day job business, we're really keen on Planet Mark. So we're talking about that and why we've joined, because we think it's a good thing. So we're going to start over with you, Alex. Now, you've got loads of equipment for your home. So you do vacuum pack machines?
Yep.
Smoke guns, it sounds very boys'
sounds
toys
very
here,
cool. Yeah.
Dehydrators, vacuum sealers, water baths, pressure cookers, and all sorts of other things. Talk to me about sous vide.
Yep.
Is that a real trend? I mean, I think, Ollie, you've got stats on that now, haven't you, from Great British Chefs. Did you say 10% of foodies own a sous vide something or other?
So 10% of our audience have a sous vide, and it's definitely... It's something that's on the ascendancy. I mean, it started in the world of chefs.
It did, yeah. It started off with the Michelin star chefs, and it's quickly progressed to the home foodie.
So those are the listeners who don't know what sous vide is. Can you just explain how it actually works and what it is?
Of course, can. So it's French for under vacuum, and it's where you take food in its raw form, you vacuum seal it, and you cook it in water at a low temperature for a very specific amount of time. So you'd cook a chicken breast for an hour and 20 minutes. At 64 degrees, and that would make the food completely safe, so it's completely pasteurised to the core, and then you'd finish it in a pan just to give it a bit of colour.
Mm. Or if you're really showy off, you'll have one of those gun things, those blaster.
Like a blowtorch.
One of them.
Yes. Favourite of Mr. Kerridge.
Now, the reason why I famously don't like sous vide machines is not because of that, because I think there's some amazing things that work really, really well with sous vide, particularly chicken, actually.
Yep.
But I do think some chefs are a bit lazy, and you go to a restaurant and they've sous vide a piece of steak, for which I have no understanding why they would do that, and then they'll flash fry it. And I think people got lazy with it. That's what I object to, not the actual process itself.
To cook sous vide, you need to be traditionally trained in the first place within the kitchen. So you know you need to understand how to prepare the food and treat it just as you would normally when you're cooking in the water bath.
So in MasterChef, I would say out of a whole hour, at least 20 minutes, you see people running backwards and forwards to their sous vide machine. That annoys me as well, frankly.
It's not good TV, is it?
No, but they love showing them running with a little packet in their hand.
Tenderizing the food, just making it beautiful, treating it with care.
So what do you do with your actual company? Do you make these, or do you source them and then sell them?
Originally, the company sourced the products. Now we actually manufacture the products as well. So we've even gone as far as having Wi-Fi enabled devices now.
Wi-Fi sous vide?
Wi-Fi sous vide.
Real boys' toys.
Real boys' toys.
That's brilliant.
So you can sit in the office and switch it on and then drive home and your 1 hour 20 chicken's cooked.
Or you can lie in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and turn on your perfect...
It's not like your scrambled eggs.
And then you make it work.
Perfect eggs in the morning.
Yeah.
And you're opening a shop.
We are. Yeah, on Connaught Street. We have just picked up the keys.
Have you?
Around about 2 hours ago.
That's exciting.
Very exciting.
Yeah. So where we'll have a cooking theatre where people can come in and actually learn all about sous vide.
Mm. And what have you found that people are really doing with sous vide? I mean, from a home environment.
Well, it used to be fine dining, dinner parties and things, but now people are using them for everyday use. So everything from breakfast in the morning through to dinner parties, through to preparing family meals.
So how do you do breakfast in the morning? How would you use that?
Perfect egg.
Like a poached egg?
A poached egg, but in the actual shell. So you cook it at 64 degrees, 45 minutes. The perfect egg.
That's quite a lot of energy, though, isn't it? You're using a lot of energy. I do the 13-minute one.
Yeah, so higher temperature.
Yeah,
yep.
But, yeah, I mean, if you're away for the weekend and you suddenly want to do poached eggs for 15 people or something, it is... And the drama of just cracking the egg.
People.
My wife does. Okay. If I crack the egg on the side, it makes me look interesting.
Nothing makes you look interesting.
But I tell you the other thing I think is interesting is, Alex, there's been a lot of... It's become much more democratic, hasn't it? Because I suppose if we go back 5 years, your average price for sous vide was what?
£400.
And now?
150.
Mm.
So it's a lot more achievable. Yeah.
Almost Christmas present-y.
Christmas is a crazy time for us.
Is
it's
it?
The number one Christmas present.
Because it's for boys, isn't it? Mostly. I always struggle. Don't laugh. I always struggle to find presents for boys. It's really hard and I don't want to buy them ties and socks.
We love gadgets.
But that is a great present for a guy who likes cooking in the kitchen.
It is. Yeah.
That's where I got mine from and I've barely used it because I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to do with it or what the best things to cook.
You need to go to one of those lessons.
I need to go to one of his lessons.
Or read one of our books. Or we've got some beautiful downloads that we've created with Ollie.
Fantastic.
There you go.
Ollie, why have you been hiding these from me for so long?
Well, because I wanted this moment of drama on the radio.
It's all about the story.
So just going back to the egg thing.
Yeah.
Cooking an egg for 45 minutes when actually I could do it for 3 minutes.
It's not the same.
Isn't it? Why? No. Sell it to me.
Because basically, if you cook it traditionally, if you boil it for 6 minutes, you're not going to get the yolk and the white to be exactly the same. Where if you cook it in the water bath, it's absolutely perfect all the way through. It's due to the way the egg cooks. So basically it cooks all the way through exactly the same.
Brilliant. See, I love egg and soldiers in the morning. I just get so excited by it. I mean, really excited.
If I cooked you eggs in the morning, you would be...
I'd marry you, wouldn't I?
You would.
Probably married already.
People have started to push boundaries, so beyond the eggs. I mean, you're seeing a lot of stuff in other areas like cocktails and things.
Cocktails. Because you're speeding up the infusion process. So things like if I want to do a limoncello, I could do a limoncello in 2 hours.
Or an infused gin or something like that.
That's very cool.
Now you've got Sue. It's bringing it back to alcohol.
So we are talking marriage.
No, it's not. We are talking marriage. No, but it's not that. It's that really shortcuts something. You know, you might spend months infusing, but actually to do something that quickly, that's quite appealing, isn't it? Because we all want things now.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
But I think there's you know, I mean, I've done a lot of vegetables in the sous vide, and I think it's one of the really interesting spaces, which is when you do cook, say, you know, carrots or asparagus, you're not losing any of the inherent properties of that piece of vegetable. It's actually cooking in its own juices, and it means that if you put a tiny amount of spices in with it...
Or even some lemon juice or something.
Yeah, some butter.
Cooking carrots in carrot juice, because you're basically... Once you're doing under the vacuum process, you're physically opening up the pores of the carrot. And
do you know the problem with this is I can feel myself beginning to think I really need to buy one.
That's what this is all about.
Yeah. Stefan, from your sort of world of farm shops and stuff, would you sell? Do people sell equipment now as well as ingredients, or are they all sticking just to food?
I think most of them are still sticking to food. I think there's significantly more demand now to have product that they've seen on TV that can be then sous-vided or whatever the right phrase is. Especially, we sell a lot more duck now, and duck breasts are especially popular for sous-vide, chicken breasts as well. I think traditionally things that people would try out through cooking methods at home because they don't quite have the control that you talked about. But I think we're not there yet for the demand. I think we're more educating around the provenance of the food, and I think yours is the next step.
Yeah,
is then how to care for that food in the sort of
and maximise the nutrition and the taste of it. Yeah,
yeah.
It's something that we've spoken about before, because we talk a lot about the food itself and the ingredients or the products. We get a lot of people come in with packaged goods, but we had I think it was Justin Cabri on with his Synergy Grill.
Yeah, that's great.
And he was talking about how you can have the best piece of meat, but if you don't cook it properly, or if the equipment that you're using isn't doing the, you know, the best service to the food, then, you know, you're kind of throwing away a great piece of meat.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And with your research as well, Ollie, I remember there's two sorts of cooks, isn't there? There's one who's very scientific and likes all the instructions, does it all to the letter. And then there's people like me who taste their
freestyle.
Way. And that's it. I'm a freestyler. I'd be up to the minute at some point. But this would really appeal to people who like to narrow down and really get it right, don't they? Because almost it really is scientific, isn't it, using a sous vide?
Yeah, and look, I think even if you look at the top-end ovens nowadays, they are way more precise. But the precision, obviously, you can get with the sous vide is you're down to 0.1 of a degree. And there is a different cooking process when you know what something weighs and you know roughly how long it takes to cook at a certain temperature. Mm. You can get a perfect result. And I think, you know, food is expensive. If you're entertaining, there's huge levels of risk involved and anxiety at times around how you're going to get it right in those big moments. And if you are doing a big dinner party, I mean, none of us are cooking regularly for 12, 15, 20 people. And suddenly, if you are doing that moment, you want a little bit of infrastructure around.
Christmas, for example.
Exactly. Mm, yeah. And it does take the stress out of things when you know there's a process you've followed. You've done it for one piece of meat. You're just replicating that 12 times at the same time and it works.
And there's a lot more margin of error in it as well, because if you've got a piece of steak that you're supposed to cook for, say, a minute and a half each side, if you go a little bit over that, you can ruin the meat. Whereas if you're cooking something at, you know, 60 degrees for 4 hours, if you leave it an extra 10 minutes or even an extra 20 minutes, it's probably going to be...
It won't make any difference. No, it's only eventually it'll start to break down. Mm.
But then it's... and then you sear it, don't you? Get that you nice caramels, caramelised stuff on the other side. Now, you also sell smoke guns. What are they?
So it's a handheld food smoker. So it's a method of cold smoking. So, for example, you could take your chicken breast and you could cold smoke it prior to cooking in the water bath.
5% of foodies own them.
There we go.
I only got the stat today, actually. We haven't yet cut it on gender, but it's clearly going to be higher amongst men. Sorry.
Do you know any female that owns a smoke gun? No, of course not. No.
I once gave my wife a blowtorch for Christmas. It's the same Christmas she gave me one. And it was amazing to look at the two different smoke,
brilliant.
The two different blowtorches and compare them.
I used my partner's blowtorch and she bought it for plumbing. So what does that say?
It's probably quite a powerful...
I'm going to move on from there.
I've got a question about the smoke gun.
Yeah.
Yep. Do you still have to sous vide afterwards?
No. No, so just think of a smoked Manhattan.
Okay. Okay.
Now you're talking.
So now we're serious now. We're talking alcohol.
And is it smoke flavoured or is there...
Just ever so slightly. So it just gives it a kind of a small kind of kick.
So what do you do? Do you put wood chips in it or something?
Basically it's a battery-powered device and you put wood chips in the top and you light them. And basically that just blows cold smoke onto the food or the drink. It just gives it a nice hit.
Mm. It would be like that guy that we met at Speciality who did the smoked oyster.
Yeah, that would be nice. Mm. That would be very nice.
I'm interested in dehydrators because, you know, I read something, you know, recently about how they are the thing. And I have to say, I almost clicked and bought one last night.
Really?
Because it was 100 and something pounds. And,
yeah.
And, do you think that's going to take off?
Massively. I think more and more people are kind of moving away from meat and they're going into vegetables and foraging, and it's a really good way of kind of preserving product. So, yeah, I agree.
And it's interesting because, I mean, I've got two small children and we're constantly doing sort of lunch boxes and, you know, dried mango and dried apple and stuff. And those bags of that stuff are really, really expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, I was trying to work out how many bags of mango would I need to go through to cover the 100 pounds. But you think that's something that's going to start to...
Absolutely, usually. More and more people are going out there and they're foraging and just things like nuts. It's a bit of tomatoes. So take a tomato and just dehydrate.
So I had some of those sun-dried tomatoes at the weekend.
Yeah.
Blimey, they were expensive. So somebody gave them to me for Christmas. California. They tasted fabulous. They really just thin slice of tomato, just dehydrated, nothing else.
Nope.
Better than having a packet of crisps or something like that. I mean, really good for you.
Again, beetroot, anything like that. Just literally use a mandolin, really kind of thinly sliced into the dehydrator. Beautiful crisp parsnip. Absolutely stunning at Christmas. Any leftover parsnip.
What's your house like, Alex? Is it full of these things? Or is it you just have them in the shop?
Depends what's happening in the kitchen. So if our chefs are cooking lots, I do tend to eat pretty well. to say the least.
But all joking aside, unfortunately, people who live in inner cities often don't have much room in their kitchen. So how are they coping with the size of all this kit?
Sous vide's really small. It goes away in the drawer at the end. So it's basically it's a clip-on device that clips onto any pot. And once you've finished the cooking process, just back in the drawer. Same with the vacuum sealer. So it's a small device, 30 centimetres wide, around about 6 or 7 centimetres deep, and again in the drawer at the end.
I can feel myself edging closer to buying one.
I'm looking forward to the programme where Sue starts by saying, what did you have for breakfast this morning? I had a sous vide egg. And we're all going to be like, whoa.
I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning to start cooking it. No,
but you can go back to sleep. Do it via the app, straight back to sleep.
Love it.
Just because you've got a 7-month-old and you're awake all the time. Pressure cookers as well. That's I'm hearing, because that used to be quite an old-fashioned thing, but actually it's back
They're
on.
Coming back.
Yeah, big style.
Massively. It's something that my nan had all the time, but no, it's really come back. I think a lot of chefs are going back to making kind of their own stocks and things, and it's the perfect way to do it. Natural.
Yeah, and I know this lovely, lovely chef called Harry Gotra, who makes amazing Indian food. She's just come out with a new book that's about pressure cooking all these lovely Indian curries, and of course pressure cookers are ideal for that.
Absolutely perfect for it. Yeah, things like your lamb. Absolutely stunning way of cooking it.
And Steve Malkin, are you a chef? Do you cooking at home, or just rely on everybody to feed you?
The latter. But we some years ago we started a small holding, so we moved into East Sussex, and we thought we'd have a bit of a stab at sort of doing our own meat and some of our own vegetables. So we've got so Roz, my wife, is just this fantastic individual, and so she looked out for these sheep called Manx Lockton, which are a rare breed. So we kind of got a flock on the go. And every 6 months, we will have a couple
of
pigs.
We kill one of them.
Well, pretty tough.
Sorry to be.
But so the boys are involved, the whole family's involved, but, you know, we just thought it was important. So we had the ability to do it.
And
so
are you a sort of gadget person in the kitchen?
No, I'm not really at home in the kitchen, other than doing the English sort of fry up. So if there's a sort of a really super efficient way of doing that, I've got multiple pots and pans on the go at any one time, so this sous vide might just sort of simplify my life significantly.
Perfect egg.
Yeah. Alex, is there any other trends that you're seeing, you know, the latest sort of kit that people are really interested in?
Charcoal cooking is the big thing.
So at home or in commercial?
At home. At home and commercial. So the yakitori grill is the biggest trend. Yeah. So it's a Japanese barbecue that people are bringing through, and the cooking again at low temperatures, it's the perfect way to finish sous vide.
So exactly what does it look like then? Does it look like a little literally like one of those,
like a fire pit? So it looks like a piece of concrete, and they're using special Bino-shan charcoal from Japan as well.
And essentially, do you actually set light to it? It's not a gas thing.
Nope, set light to it.
Set light to it, and then you've got a little barbecue going in the middle of your kitchen. I mean, obviously, no health and safety problems there. And
small children wandering around, it's perfect.
No, it's great. Yeah, set light to the house. Yeah. But that, as you say, that's great to finish off sous vide, because you'll get that lovely
loads of flavour.
Charred flavour.
Yeah.
And are people building those into units nowadays?
No, just countertop devices.
Okay.
So maybe use it outside or under the extraction, because they're quite, they don't give off much smoke at all.
So you could actually put that on your hob?
You could.
That's what you're saying.
You could indeed, yeah.
How do you know when it's a trend that's going to stick? Because I bought a chocolate fountain. And that didn't really
that was never going to stick.
Stefan, why did you do that? What were you thinking?
It was the mid-noughties. I mean, popcorn maker and chocolate fountain.
It's just like a spiralizer. Everybody thought spiralizers were going to be the big thing. Yeah, it's just,
yeah, I've got one of those.
You're a marketing man's dream.
I think some people, though, kind of, you know, just jump on a lot of those kind of trends and do those kind of things, but I think when some of this stuff has a fundamental kind of reason of why you should embrace it, and it's in those cases I think it's gonna, I mean, the chocolate fountain is always going to gather dust, and if it isn't, you
have you keep hold of it, being
no,
the
it takes a long time to clean, and it just,
it must use a lot of chocolate,
it uses a lot of chocolate, and then one day it just got one clean too many, so it never actually got clean before it was disposed. I'm like, sustainably, that's awful. But yeah, it just
crazy. We tend to find that the ones that stick come from the professional kitchen first.
Yeah. Mm.
So same with the yakitori grill,
because they're proven and they're used again and again and again.
Yeah,
and people want to look up to those people and like, oh, I can do this at home.
Yeah.
It's my favourite chef, does it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So Yakitori Grill, you heard it here first. Alex Shannon, Sous Vide Tools, has got his finger on the pulse.
I'm assuming we can buy a Yakitori Grill on your site.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Watch this space. We'll maybe update when you can. Mm.
So your company, we can find out all about your tools at sousvidetools.com.
Correct.
And you've got your new shop.
We have. There we have on Connaught Street.
Connaught Street. W2. So that's in London, obviously. And can people get stuff online if they're interested in this?
They can, yeah. They can visit our website, sousvidetools.com.
Great. Okay, lovely. Now, Stefan, we've already established that you're not very good at understanding what fashions and trends are in food. I think we've established that quite well.
Oh, it's nice not to be on the receiving end of it for a change.
I'm only joking. Now, you started off Heartier, and you describe yourself as everyone's local farm shop. Just explain why you're passionate about doing this and why you really felt, you know, it was needed.
So I used to work in the big bad world of supermarket. I used to run a supermarket behind a vision and...
Lidl, I think we're allowed. Yeah, we mention everybody's names here. Yeah, we don't mind about being sued.
That's fine. Lidl's got, like any supermarket, there's a lot of good. But also, especially when it comes to meat, pretty much all the supermarkets do a lot of corner cutting to do what they need to do to get product on shelves.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the volume and value game started to degrade a bit as you start, you know, negotiating product on spreadsheet as opposed to necessarily understanding and thinking about the where it's all come from and how it all fits together.
So are you saying that you felt very removed from the process?
Yeah, I think so. From a product level, I think you are... Yeah, as a supermarket buyer, and this is not just for meat, and it's not just for one or other supermarket. I just think that you're buying something as opposed to necessarily buying a foodstuff that someone's putting in their mouth. Mm. I think, and that disconnect grows as the product categories that you manage become bigger. So if you're negotiating milk or any dairy for that matter or meat, the reality is that the numbers that you're negotiating and the sheer the sort of minutiae around those numbers that make a big difference to a business's profit margins or targets and mean that you disassociate yourself more with
what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you felt quite strongly about this. Mm. So instead of just taking the paycheck and paying your mortgage, you decided to do something about it.
Yeah, I did. I decided to go out on my own and start an e-commerce business that attempted to change the way that people sourced and bought their meat. There was certainly a lot of great producers out there in the UK, and there's certainly a lot of people that want to buy great product, but those two groups don't necessarily have the easiest means of talking to each other.
Mm. So it's easy if let's say you live in a lovely village and you've got a great farmer's market and the farmer's there, that's great, but not everybody's in that position, are they?
Yeah, right. I mean, there's that, and there's also if you live here in London, you have the option of walking past maybe three or four great greengrocers or butchers on the way back to the tube station. But not everyone in every town or city or village has that, especially now that, you know, the number of butchers or cheesemongers on the high street has diminished so much. So we look to take product from where it is to where it isn't, I suppose is an easy way of summarising it, in that we use networks of local farms and local butchers and local farm shops to fulfil our orders. So we continue to support those that are there and that are trading, but equally we want to get that product via the courier network and via distributing it to people that don't have that on their doorstep.
And do you provide in-depth provenance information for every single item that's on your site?
Yeah, we do. So when a customer opens their box from us, so the way our orders come is in a sort of recycled or recyclable cardboard box with the relevant insulation. And in there, they will learn where the products come from. There'll be information about who's butchered that, where that farm is in the UK, and as well as then ideas on how best to use the product they bought. I mean, a lot of the customers come to us with a specific thing in mind, but we also have, you know, where they'll come on and say, I want to buy this four rib of beef and I know what I'm doing with it, thank you very much. And some customers will come and say, actually, I want to buy this seasonal box where I don't know what I'm getting, but, you know, I can have a stab that in November it's going to contain more game than it would do in the in the summer or something like that.
And is this consumer?
Yes.
So this is not business. This is your
have a handful of street food traders and that sort of stuff, right. But we are domestic consumer focused. Yeah.
Interesting. And where's your biggest market at the moment?
It would be in what I suppose you'd pigeonhole as commuter towns.
Right.
So, or affluent towns and cities that don't necessarily have huge inhabitant numbers, sort of, I don't know, Guildford or Cambridge, Harrogate, Gloucester, Cheltenham, those kind of places that, that you know, where people are discerning about what they want to buy, and but don't necessarily have everything there on their doorstep. Although, ironically, they may have it on their doorstep, but...
But they go for the convenient option, which is, you know, search for it online, buy it online, and it just shows up.
Yeah. But my understanding is what you're trying to do is show the people behind what's going on. So it's quite people-focused. You know, this is a farmer, this is what they're doing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So trying to raise their profile and explain what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I think...
Championing them.
Yeah, going back to where we started on the sort of supermarket conversation, you lose the human elements of the supply chain. And
I thought Tesco's had all those farms. Willow Farm, isn't that a real farm?
Woodside
Farm?
Allegedly.
No, it's not.
Yeah, I think...
The myth has just been shattered.
Yeah, yeah. A prime example, right, the so-called fake farm scandal, is an example of how, as a marketing attempt to humanise it, or to give it some level of provenance, but when you lift the lid, there's perhaps not everything there that you might expect to be there.
It's just a fat lie. They're not... That's basically what it is.
Yeah,
it's
I wouldn't even say it's marketing, because it's so it's misleading not, it's and it's so, lie. Yeah.
When I've been marketing all my life, I would never do that, because you'll get found out. How many stupid things
they did.
Do. Good.
Yeah. And it's, but that, in many respects, once the lid has been lifted, helps businesses like mine and helps the businesses that we work with. And it says, well, actually, no, this is a farm. You can go on Google and see what the farmhouse is valued for on Zoopla or whatever. You know, there's tangible touch points.
But it's interesting, isn't it, though, because, you know, we're certainly seeing a massive growth in the return to butchers. And I think things like the recent alleged scandals have certainly further driven that trend. But even at the butcher level, you don't get to sort of know, oh, this is from that guy who's just down the road. It's interesting that, you know, even, you know, very few butchers are good at the provenance story around who they are supporting. And they often have quite a close network of suppliers.
They might say it's local, though, but that's as far as it goes often.
And what does that necessarily mean?
Exactly.
I think, yeah, certainly with those that we work with, we're very sort of fastidious, for want of another word, to understand what is beneath their lid as well, where they're sourcing from. I think, you know, a number of butchers will be part of small chains or groups, and a number of them will source from, you know, the Birmingham meat market, Smithfield meat market here in London, which don't necessarily have all the provenance that we necessarily bestow on them. You know, Smithfield is imported, and that's, you know, potentially fine for the market that they serve, but it's not what we're expecting at our local butcher.
And can I talk about waste as well? Because that exercises you quite a bit. So you're really keen. Well, I think you're quite upset by the waste that you saw in supermarkets as well.
Yeah, I think when you go back to that negotiation point, you know, into your margin, you're factoring in, well, okay, there's going to be X percent write-off or X percent waste. And, you know, the harsh reality of putting product on, you know, 1,000 supermarket shelves multiplied by the number of products that's on that shelf is, in order to have the availability there, you're going to have to waste product to make sure you've got constant availability of everything you say you're going to have as a supermarket.
So what sort of level of waste are you talking about in terms of meat?
I mean, it depends wildly on the retailer, and depends wildly on the time of year, but you know you would expect to see probably 2 or 3%, which, when you equate that
when you
to,
look at them, yeah, the amounts,
yeah, when you look at the sheer volume of that. Now, obviously, some supermarkets will write it down, i.e. reduce it to 10p just to shift it, which, you know, has a better feeling than just, you know, taking it off shelf.
What do they do with it if they do take it off shelf?
So once it's gone past, I mean, there's been a whole lot of coverage at the moment about shelf life and use by versus best before and that sort of stuff. I mean, it's still the law that once it's taken off shelf and the product expires, that it then it's not fit for human consumption.
What do they do with it?
So then usually it'd be frozen down, it might go into, may go into animal food depending on its grading, or maybe destroyed.
Mm. Steve, as far as Planet Mart's concerned, food waste is a real issue, isn't it? I mean, it's just, you know, it's criminal when so many people are using food banks and all that sort of thing. We've got to do as many things as we can, haven't we, to stop food waste.
Yeah, everything we've been talking about really has got a sustainability angle on it today, which is really heartening and interesting. It just goes to show that there's touch points across everything that we do. But there's a huge amount of effort going behind reducing food waste, which is hard, you know, which is fantastic. But just waste generally, you've seen everything to do with sort of plastic, which is coming through everything on Planet Earth 2, revving everybody up, which is great. The fact that we can't recycle our coffee cups, which is insane and ridiculous that you can have a company that doesn't do that. And then the food waste issue. We found a charity the other day that called Fair Share, and they are just awesome.
Great stuff.
And so they'll take that food waste and they'll distribute it to people who really, really need it. And there's a lot of those in the UK.
Which is what we would hope would happen, really. Yeah. That's the ideal outcome, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think half of the problem is logistics.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly the same thing. Yeah,
because you don't want to spend, you know, the huge amounts of greenhouse gases, you know, shipping. Yeah, because that rather defeats the object as well.
Exactly, and I think but it's interesting, and I think some of the things we're talking about with sous vide, perhaps, highlight this, is we're seeing a growth as well in some of the unsung parts of the animal that previously weren't selling that well. I mean, that creates sometimes its own problem because there's huge spikes in demand for beef short rib or products that, you know, previously, or flat iron is another example.
Some people call them Cinderella cuts. The sort of, we're talking about kidneys and, you know, you had that lovely piece of research, remember, which
the awful map of the UK.
The awful map of the UK, which Great British developed, which is brilliant, We'll send it over to you, it's brilliant,
We renamed entire parts of the country based upon what they over-indexed on what they were eating of parts of animals.
Basically, testicles are big in Scotland, we found.
I think that's the only thing I remembered from it.
Well, we'll move
all
on.
The important stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But so like, that helps as well.
But like heart and, you know, all those sorts of things.
Yeah, or just even actually, you know, cuts that would previously get automatically put in the sort of the mince bucket, as it were. you know, skirt and flat iron and shin.
Skirt and shin make the best pies, undoubtedly. I bet you could sous vide those, couldn't you, Alex?
You can, yeah.
Or pressure cooker them. It'd be delicious.
Because
you're
completely tenderising them.
Yeah. And that's, you know, those cuts are on the up. I mean, balancing the carcass remains a butcher's and therefore us as a retail biggest challenge, because the supermarkets really, really don't care about that.
Yeah.
You know, they, you know, one supermarket will run a promotion on chicken breasts, but of course that
they're not then worried about how many thighs get thrown away or legs or whatever.
Exactly. So, you know, and as consumers, unless we, I know that sounds like an obvious point, but actually not many people would stop and think, well, hang on a minute, where are the thighs? You know what I mean? Because we're so conditioned to just buy a pack. And do we want a 3-breast pack or a 5, you know, whatever. Other than that, we don't really think much.
Yeah.
But on the flip, you suddenly do occasionally, you come across some, and I remember going around the Gressingham duck factory and literally noting that, you know, all the duck down was going to America for duvets and all the feet were going to China, and literally the carcasses went to France. And it was this amazing supply chain where, you know, one level duck came in one end and the bits that we eat, you know, the legs and the breasts were used for UK consumption, and then the rest of the stuff just headed out on supply chain. And that was kind of in one level amazing.
Yeah, this is fantastic. But I think what Stefan's point is that supermarkets don't really understand how sometimes they'll then completely cock that up by, you know, by
spiking it.
Yeah, spike it, yeah. So Stefan, do you deliver across the whole of the UK?
Yeah, we do. A handful of highlands and islands. Sadly, don't make the cut. But yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So most people in the UK. Yeah. So if you're interested in the sort of thing that Stefan's talking about, you need to go on to heartier.com. We can find out all about that stuff then, can't we?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I'm going to have a little break. I'm going to have a little Google to consider whether I should buy a sous vide machine off Alex. And we're going to have a little break and we'll come back in a couple of minutes.
Nice surprise, darling. Something to celebrate?
We've just got a very tasty government cash reward for innovation.
All that blood, sweat and late nights finally paid off then. How come?
Thanks to our buddies at Breakthrough Funding. Yeah! Sorry, just slipped out. It all sailed through painlessly in no time at all. Over 40k, thank you very much, and the planet will benefit too.
And new shoes for me? Cheers.
Your company could qualify for Innovation Cash too. Find out online now by answering just 6 qualifying questions at breakthroughfunding.com. Yeah!
Hi there, and you're back with the Food Talk Show. We've been talking to Alex Shannon of Sous Vide Tools, and I've decided I'm going to buy a sous vide machine, so there you go. And Stefan Porter of Heartier. Now, our other studio guest is Steve Malkin. Steve, hi there. You've sort of started off Planet Mark. I got that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You did it by meeting Sir Tim Smith, who's co-founder of the Eden Project. I'm sure most people know what the Eden Project is, but can you just describe that meeting and how that all sort of happened in the first place?
Yeah, I'd love to. So does everyone know the Eden Project? It's this fantastic...
We've got about 60,000, 100,000, whatever, 200,000 listeners. So there might be the odd person that doesn't know who it is.
Maybe those based in Malta or out in the middle
California.
Of
California.
Mm. So it might be that for those people overseas, there might be an Eden Project coming your way because there's an Eden Project destination in the UK. It's in part of the UK called Cornwall, and it's a wonderful destination for people who are holidaying down in Cornwall. But in actual fact, the purpose of the Eden Project is a huge charity, and it's a transformational charity. And they help people connect with each other and also with nature. And Sir Tim Smith and his colleagues down there transformed a disused clay pit and turned it into almost one of the wonders of the world. And so you've got these enormous biomes, and they've got sort of the biggest rainforest in captivity down there. And it's really, really worth a visit. 1 million people go a year. And just to let you know what their expansion plans are, there's the next Eden is being built in China right now.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Mm. And his plan is to build an Eden Project on every continent apart from Antarctica. But you never know.
Chicken, yeah. So you met up with Sir Tim. Why did you think there was something missing in terms of sort of businesses, and why did you launch sort of Planet Mark?
Well, we were running a sustainability program, and what we recognised is that today we've been talking in around sort of issues around supply chain and trying to understand what's going on in supply chains. And we had a certification program. It was proving that smaller organisations really, really wanted to do the sustainability thing, wanted to demonstrate they could do the right thing with their products and services, and would be willing to sign up to a certification program to demonstrate that they were being sustainable. But what we wanted to do is really amplify that. And so we went down to see the guys at the Eden Project and Sir Tim, and we said, listen, we want to create a brand that everyone can understand at a glance that something good is taking place here, and we want to call it the Planet Mark. But we want to do it with a partner who people think is fantastic and
who recognize. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a big piece around sustainability, which is there's loads of data, and earlier on we might have been touching on energy consumption and really quite gritty things, but there's fantastic stuff around sustainability. It's around storytelling, and it's about telling stories of the amazing changes which are taking place right now around us that are good for us, and they're good for the planet, and they're good for people, and actually they're really, really good for business. And that's why we wanted the Eden Project on board.
And have you got some examples of that, Steve? You know, things that you've been inspired by since you've been doing it?
Oh, there's lots. So we certify all sorts of organisations, charities, schools, businesses, big and small. And every single one of them has got a story to tell, because the sustainability that takes place there, whether it's cutting carbon or, selling seasonal produce, each one of those, somebody inside that company has decided to do something perhaps slightly different. And so with that, then you can find these incredible stories where... People might be really passionate about climate change, right? And it's a massive issue. It's probably the biggest issue facing our times at this moment. But this sort of connectivity between switching the lights off and switching your machines off and winding things down at night can be super boring, the idea that we can affect this huge issue by just switching off small appliances.
'Cause we feel like we're too small a part of the cog, don't we?
Yeah, inertia. Unless you find somebody inside an organisation who's so passionate about it, they're going to turn it into something really interesting. And those are the people that we kind of hook into inside every organisation that we work with. Because generally, everyone wants to do the right thing. And there's passion there that just is ready to be unlocked.
So I came to see you before Christmas and said, I think we should do this thing. Because it's a way of somebody externally verifying that you're doing the right thing. You know, you're not boasting about it yourself. Somebody's come and looked at it for you. So we've got like 20 people, and basically you've said to us, right, we're going to look at all your utility bills. We're going to look at your waste disposal costs, your mileage, your train travel, la la la. So you the first thing you do is do an audit, isn't it, and have a look about how much you're spending. And I know it's not just about that, but as a business owner, it's like, oh, okay, well, actually, we could save a good few £1,000 a year here, even it's quite a small business.
And so,
quite an incentive, so that's a good payback. But also, more importantly, it gives you a measure. So you can see the difference between turning the light off and not. And I think that's people want to see what that means, don't they?
They really do. And I think that so we're about the sort of connectivity between data to inform what's going on, making really good business decisions, and sort of marketing and communication. And for really good marketing and communication, you need to start from an element, you know, a place of truth and understanding. So for every organisation that we certify to the Planet Mark, what we do is we'll do an annual carbon footprint. So every single year, every company is measuring their carbon emissions, and we encourage them and help them every single year to reduce those carbon emissions. If you reduce your carbon, then you can maintain the whole of the Planet Mark. But in reducing carbon, what you're looking at is, well, how can I reduce my energy consumption? You know, is it through my travel and transport? Is it through my office? Is it through my energy use? Where is that? Is it by reducing waste? Is it reducing water consumption and so on? So as soon as you get a company to gather together all of those environmental impacts, I mean, energy is an environmental impact and so is water consumption, and we net that into carbon. But in actual fact, you can also net it into cost saving. So on average, companies that we certify reduce their carbon by 10% per employee per annum.
Per employee?
Yeah. Wow. So we kind of bring it into the personal perspective so that if you can make it like, okay, if you can reduce your carbon by 10%, you know, would you try and do that again next year? And so it becomes like a personal sort of target as well as a business target. But that 10% equates to something like £100 cost saving per employee per annum. So if we were a board and if there's a financial director sitting in this room, they might say, well, I can just, you know, multiply £100 by the number of employees. That's how much money we could save if we're reducing our carbon footprint.
We're probably not even trying very hard. Just thinking about it, just knowing about it.
A lot of this is behaviour change, you know, sort of stuff where we're just asking people to think again and make a good informed decision about the stuff that they choose to do.
And I guess the worst thing in our office is we've got a photocopier. People love our photocopier. And they forget to put it on black and white when, you know, they're producing something and they print off a 60-page report and it's in colour, one-sided. Just to let you know, staff, I'm not very happy about that. But it's not just the cost of that. I mean, that is just a waste. And I think because, you know, they're not going to listen to me moaning at them because I moan a lot, so they just zone out. But if it's being measured, then everybody goes, oh, right, yeah, I get that now. You know, because you just see it and it's tangible.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to print on that. They just forget, you know.
Oh, and I think people were frustrated at seeing waste. You know, no one wants to see stuff wasted and nobody wants to chop trees down. So if you turn it into something quite emotive about, look, who wants to sort of ravage trees? So there's all sorts of stuff you can do with your photocopier. And one of those things might be don't have it. You know, so you could go paperless, but you could replace it.
We're pretty good actually, because I think I've only got 3 filing cabinets in the whole place, and you know, there's a lot of us, and we deal with HMRC, so I think that's pretty good going. But we can do more. Of course, we can do more, just by really focusing on it.
Yeah, you can print double sided. You can have this kind of like particular font that has got lots of sort of voids in it.
So you can't read it. You
reduce the amount of ink that you use. And so there's so many escalating, incredible impacts.
Right, so hear that, staff, now. I'll tell you what, like bold fonts are out from now on. No emphasis, please, on reports.
No titles on PowerPoint.
Interesting what you say about HMRC, though. I mean, joking aside, I mean, there's a huge amount of paperwork associated with them. I mean,
they insist you keep your records for 7 years. I mean, what for? Why?
Well, yeah. Also, I imagine that they're not inspiring the most sustainable use of paper.
No, they write to you. They're not allowed to email. They have to write to you. Yeah. I mean, who does
painful.
That?
But we're working with the legal sector with an organisation called the Legal Sustainability Alliance, and sort of lawyers print so much stuff. So there's these sort of stories inside these organisations. So, well, actually, they are radically reducing the amount of paper they consume. Because it's actually, it's good for business if they reduce the amount of paper they consume. So what they might be hampered is on sort of regulatory requirements. So we have to tackle some of those regulatory requirements. And so why aren't we going paperless and can we do it faster? And so you sort of change in behaviour, but also you need to change regulation at the same time.
And I think what we try to do, what we should be doing is getting people to opt in if they want printed stuff or other things. Yeah, whereas my accountant sends me stuff and I go, can you not send me, I don't look at anything on paper, you know, just email it. And he says, oh, well, we always send it to clients. I think we'll always not send it to clients and ask them if they want it in paper. And that's a better way around, isn't it? You know, framing things for people in a different way.
Yeah, and, you know, think again, you know, you've got a disruptive business model, Stefan, haven't you? So there's an accountant called Chapters Financial, and they've decided to do a lot of their stuff online, including the conversations they have with their customers. So they say, don't travel to see us. Why don't we do this? They've got great video conferencing. So they're actually reducing the travel time and the time it takes for their customers to come and see them and so on, because there's business benefit in doing that. And they've won an award for it, which is fantastic.
Really,
it's just
good.
Thinking again about how you do your business.
And in the food sector, obviously packaging's really important. And we have a lot of producers on here who know that if their stuff doesn't look great on the shelf, especially in a supermarket context, you know, that it's not going to work. Are you seeing any sort of trends in sort of packaging and trying to look at different types of materials and inks and that sort of thing?
Yes, we are. And it sort of comes down to, look, it's essential you keep your product, the quality of your product is essential, because that's what your business is going to run on. But actually, there are ways and means of looking again about how you are packaging. And we had a conversation, Stefan, about how you're using your packaging and the focus you've got on reducing it. Fact is, though, you need to collaborate to help make these things happen. So if you are going to make a change, then unquestionable you want to engage with your supply chain to help make something new and happen, so that you are reducing the amount of packaging that you've got and whilst maintaining your product quality. And therein lies a brilliant business opportunity, because actually suppliers are busting a gut to talk to the people who they are selling to, their clients. And at the end of the day, the end user, the consumer, should be benefiting from this and not being hamstrung by having a whole load of stuff that they need to take to the recycling centre. So actually everybody wins all the way down the line. And you mentioned there's a company we work with who recycle used cooking oil, and they turn it into biodiesel. So proper oils run around the UK and the countryside, taking away this big problem and turning it into something good. And they've created a whole business around selling biodiesel.
Like toast ale, bio beans, good, isn't it? Coffee grinds.
Yeah. There's so many of them now, which is great to see.
Yeah, it's good. Excellent. So why did you sort of go into this? I mean, you look normal. You're not wearing corduroys or sort of, you know, anything like that. So, but what really struck you in the... Is he wearing corduroys?
Yeah,
jeans.
What
sort of struck you, you know, to be passionate about this and do something about it? Because lots of us feel we should, but not to the extent where they'll change their career and go for that.
For me, it was we were running a marketing company at the time, and we were bringing up a young family. We were pretty good in the marketing company in helping organisations sell their product out. And so it was sort of not exactly rabid consumerism, but I didn't feel like we were really necessarily contributing as much as we could do. And one of the issues around sustainability and climate change, I think, is we can measure the hell out of stuff. And we're really, really quite good at that now. Everyone is good at measuring things. But what do you do with that data? And then how do you engage people in a really exciting topic, and how do you communicate it in such a way that it engenders people to want to get involved? And so the marketing communications of sustainability are really important, and I thought that's where we thought we could make a bit of a difference and create the Planet Mark and help organisations and every individual in there feel like they're contributing, because we were talking about this sort of big
inertia. So unless
you
inspire people, it's not going to happen. And I think that's... So what you're saying is that's what you feel good at. You're good at that bit.
Hopefully, yeah. And, you know, there are... our place in the scheme of things is to help organisations get the business benefit from sustainability so they will do more. And that's the bit which is working, and therefore there's no barrier to entry. Everyone in every organisation can do it. And that's what we wanted to bring to market.
And Alex, as a producer who's actually now making stuff, has it suddenly hit you about, well, I've got to be really careful with my resources because these things are expensive, so I need to, you know, I need to be really careful about how we do things?
Unbelievably so. Even from things from travel. We're looking at it in more and more detail and just trying to do things via video conferencing. So we've just installed a new video conferencing system in the boardroom.
Brilliant.
It's not just from a sustainability point of view, it's just it's the way the world's
practical.
Going.
Practical. Yeah.
Time as well, isn't
it? Mm.
Just
yeah.
Time saving. It's just
18 hours on a plane. It's
and difficult. If you cut a flight out, it makes such a humongous difference to your business carbon footprint. So if you, you know, so it makes great business sense to sit, you know, and if you're going to, sometimes you need to see customers, there's no doubt about it. But actually video conferencing now is so good.
It used to be awful because when I first, I remember I worked at Barclays Bank, you know, like
in the old days, it was
yeah, it was like Max Headroom. Do you remember that? It's like it was all, but now it's so much
better. We used to do it across Asia, and it was tremendous fun because we'd have one team in Shanghai, one in India, one in Indonesia, and then another guy based in Singapore. And invariably, someone would freeze every 2 minutes. Yeah, it was just like okay.
I mean, brilliant. It's still not perfect, but it's so much better.
It is much better.
And even some of the big institutions are embracing it. I had a 2-hour mortgage consultation with a big bank via Skype.
That was thrilling.
It was horrible, but it was nice. The problem is
they can then see you as well. Yep. When you're there going, do you agree? Yes, yes. Actually, if you're looking for your asleep on your desk, they actually can tell you're not concentrating.
Yeah, moving back to the topic. the other thing that we were talking about, Steve, that I'm quite frustrated about, and one of the reasons why I wanted to try and work with you at PlanetMark, is I want to try and find an accreditation that proves that you are what you're doing is having a good social impact, or that you conduct business in the right ethical way, so that some of the horrible people I've come across in business can't get one of those because they're horrible and they don't, you know, they're immoral and they don't pay people and do all sorts of stuff. But you can't tell who those people are when you're doing business, you know, and lots of us in business say, I just want to do people I like and that I get on with and I can trust. Would you be able to extend your PlanetMark into that sort of area about trying to look at social benefit as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a really important thing. So we're looking at how we embed social value measurement into the PlanetMark, and we'll be the first to do that. So we're pretty well under control with the environmental impacts, and we can help organizations do that really easily. So it takes the pain away for them, and then they can concentrate on what they can do to contribute to the environment. But in terms of social impact, it's incredibly important. And, you know, this is a sort of a space that a lot of people might be calling sort of CSR. Mm-hmm. And what we want to do is if we can help them measure the positive contributions they're making to society in terms of paying people well, in terms of looking after people, in terms of helping people be healthy, then that's something that we want to start to quantify. Because then every business can demonstrate actually they're really contributing to society and they're doing a good thing.
Because it's the way it is about your employees as well, isn't it? What you're like as an employer, as well as the impact you have on your customers, and then the impact you have locally as a business sitting in a community. All those aspects.
All of those aspects. And, an organisation in a community has a significant role to play, and lots do. And what we want to do is award those people who are making those contributions inside those organisations, and to say thank you.
So Mike Ashley probably won't get one, I'm thinking.
Well, I haven't worked with Mike, but the fact is that most organisations are doing the right thing.
Or want to,
they really actually want to do more. So this is the exciting thing about this moment in time we're in right now. We need these changes, and people are stepping up to the plate.
Steve, I get really frustrated because I think a lot of politicians, you know, and also the media say that all business is bad and that we're all trying to just get profit and tread on people. And, well, loads of people aren't trying to do that, trying to do really good businesses responsibly. Mm. I mean, and if you look at Stefan, what he's doing, you know, you should have a sort of mark to prove that you're trying to make happen.
Of course, as you grow a business and as you manage a broader team, you learn more and more about what things you need to do better and what things, you know. But I think there are so many businesses like mine and like others that are trying to do good,
yes,
and along the way need support to continue that. And
But I think a lot of the stuff is measured in the big corporations. There's a lot of talk of CSR is done at the big corporation level. I'm actually really interested in the stuff where a small business, and you know, we work with chefs, you know, a chef sets up a major restaurant in an area, the impact they have locally can be enormous. They start getting farmers to produce new things that margins up their business. They start to push them to raise the quality of their product. Then a little B&B opens up around the corner. People start to Airbnb their properties. So people come and stay and experience these restaurants. You know, there's all this trickle down that goes from leading lights doing this stuff. And I often think that we focus on major corporations and the impact that they're having. But actually, in a country with a massively rural, you know, landscape, and small, we also need to think about what's happening with the small businesses all over the country.
Much more people employed by small businesses and large corporations. I worked a little bit in the CSR space a few years ago. I got really cross because a lot of them were doing their annual reports and putting a, you know, one page, or let's put something about our CSR. I really didn't think they were doing anything much about it. Or they might have a couple of projects and go, yeah, tick, right, that's okay, we've done that bit. And I didn't feel it was hugely authentic or was right the way through the organisation either.
Well, it's about this piece about embedding these values inside an organisation. You know, historically, we've always thought of the big guys. You know, they've got the money to actually have whole departments doing this stuff. We go back to the conversation we had with Tim down at the Eden Project, saying we want to do this for a small and medium-sized organisations because they're the lifeblood of the country, and they can do this stuff. And the fact is, they are already doing it, but they're just not getting their arms around it and calling it something. Yeah. And that societal impact, that trickle down, is really where it's at. And so it's not just for the big corporates. This is absolutely for everybody, and everybody can be making a quantifiable contribution, and it's exciting.
But I think what's also interesting is that you're hopefully challenging people on an annual basis, which is that we all are where we are as organisations, and as many of us around this table are leaders of our organisation, and we all know where we're strong and where we're weak. But actually, we all do need on some level a mirror shined up to sort of say, okay, look, let's move the needle on this stuff and then this stuff, which big corporations have the infrastructure to do, but to try and come up with a mechanism that allows smaller organisations to do that is very interesting.
Well, and also with Planet Mark and Steve's team, is they'll say, you're struggling with that. We've seen somebody else doing that and they're doing it like this. And you know, it just so helps you because you're in a community of people all trying to make that work.
Yeah, it is. And I think that point about continuous improvement, you know, every year, just push yourself a little bit more is really important, you know, and it fires people up. So, we, you know, everyone kind of likes to hit a target. So we just help set a target that, you know, everyone signs up to, and then we will improve together.
That's a good thing to end on, isn't it? Good timing, good timing. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us. Steve Morgan of Planet Mark. If you want to get Planet Mark, I'm getting it, so you should. It's theplanetmark.com, and it's good for business in all senses of the word. So it's definitely worth having a look. And I have to say, we're all really up for it. So all our staff are really trying to look at different ways of doing it, and probably won't involve getting rid of the whole photocopier, but anyway, there's that. Stefan Porter of Heartier.com, get your meat there.
It's not a new slogan.
Get your meat there, yeah, there you go.
That was free.
I won't
free
charge marketing. You much for that. Thank you.
I'll wait for the invoice.
And Alex Shannon, yeah, I'm right on that website now, sousvidetools.com, and it sounds like a very exciting period of time for you as well, all growing, all very exciting.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Can you hurry up and get the yakitori grill in?
Yeah,
we're trying.
Those two.
We're trying.
Sounds good.
Yeah, on a very slow boat from Japan.
Guys, definitely going to buy one of those, aren't you, Guy?
Absolutely. You need all the gadgets.
Yes, you need all the gadgets.
Do your vegetarian stuff.
Yes, I can.
When you going to stop being vegan? I know you're just doing it for a little while.
I'm going to see how long I can keep it up.
Yeah.
Asparagus on a yakitori grill.
Oh, it sounds good.
But you need butter on it, and you can't have butter.
So. Well, it's gone really wrong now.
Or wrap it, or wrap bacon round, and you can't have that either. That's not going to work. You've been listening to the Food Talk Show, and we're syndicated across hundreds of thousands of listeners in all sorts of places. Thank you to my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of Food Rush. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you very much.
And you'll be even slimmer next week. And to Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. Thanks, Ollie. You won't.
I won't.
And nor will I.
No, well.
And we don't care.
We enjoyed our curry the other day.
Yeah, we did. If you'd like to get in touch with us via Twitter, it's at Food Talk Show. Or you can listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts or links to our wonderful guests today. And I hope you have a really good week. Bye now.